let me just, you know, recall that for this we need to understand what ADS is, and we have seen a couple of coordinate systems which are useful. It's the embedding coordinate system Y, where the your ADS spacetime looks like a, you know, hyperboloid, which looks everywhere the same. You have the global coordinate system where you have infinite cylinder. But what we'll be mostly using is the Poincaré, which is only part of this global ADS. It's just, you know, this part of that. But what is nice about the Poincaré system is that it, you know, for every z equal to constant slice, so if I set z equal to 0 here, you just have a Minkowski spacetime. So you have like slices of Minkowski spacetime filling your whole ADS space. And so in this coordinate system, however, you have the boundary at z equal to 0, which corresponds to the surface of that cylinder. But at the same time, you have a Poincaré horizon at z goes to infinity, which would correspond to the slices like this. And so on these slices here, it will be z equal to infinity. You can think about it like a Rindler horizon if you want, but the Poincaré ADS only covers that part of the global ADS. Okay? So we will need this for calculations today. So now, ADS-CFT conjecture, right? So what is ADS-CFT conjecture? So we said that, well, there's a duality between two theories. One theory lives in flat space in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and it's the n equal to 4 super young males with that number of colors and C. And this is supposed to be dual or exactly equivalent to what happens to type 2b super string theory on ADS 5 cross S 5. And so I put here some source, so you can put some sources here. And yes?
So I don't know if I'm wrong, but I remember when you were first writing the NC, it corresponded to these number of slices. How come that corresponds to the number of colors? Did it not correspond to the number?
So I didn't really prove it, right? But what NC was for us in that, you know, two pictures was number of these D3 brains, right?
Yeah.
So more D3 brains we put, more that's what the NC number counts. And you can show that this precisely corresponds to, you know, how many, you know, you have this non-abelian gauge theory, and so basically you get another index, A and B indices, which run from 1 to NC if you want, but then you know, your string can go from here to there. And so I'm really numbering where from the string goes, from where it goes to where it goes, right? And so you have this extra index on your gauge field, right? And so in the end, you have something which looks like a gauge field, but it has two additional indices telling you where from you are going and to where you are going. And so these guys will be, think about it like a Maxwell field. But each of these things here is a matrix, which is NC times NC matrix. Okay.
Okay, so that's the colors.
Yeah, that's the number of colors. And something, yeah. Okay. And so you have parameters on this gauge theory side. How basically the Hopf coupling is, you know, how strong the coupling is and how many colors you have. And there's a precise prescription how these translate to the stringy parameters, where the G string is the interaction constant for strings, and this guy is, you know, the length of the string divided by the radius of the ADS space L. So I denoted by capital L. So capital L is the same as small l. Okay, very good. So, however, this is too strong. So this is supposed to be valid for any value of the coupling, and it's supposed to be very, very general, and nobody knows how to calculate anything because you don't understand this theory, and you don't understand, certainly don't understand that theory. So what people do is that they formulate a useful weaker version of this, where they at least understand the right-hand side. And so I was trying to convince you last week is that if we take the limit lambda goes to infinity and the number of colors goes to infinity, then you can approximate this thing here as weak gravity, weak supergravity. So your superstring theory, which is completely quantum, and you have loops, and you have extended strings and stuff like that. When these extended strings become point-like, and when the, you know, quantum corrections, when the loops are suppressed, then you can approximate this thing here by type 2b supergravity. So classical weak gravitational theory. Okay. But of course, this is just a partition function, and we can also use, if we are really in, you know, classical regime, we can probably use something like the WKB approximation for the partition function. And so we know that the WKB approximation is that we're just taking, instead of the parse integral here, we are taking just the exponential of the classical solution here. So really, you know, this thing here is an exponential of classical action evaluated, of supergravity evaluated on a classical solution in the bulk. Okay, and so this is certainly something we already know. We used it for black hole thermodynamics. We know how to calculate it in principle. So basically what you are really doing is that you are transforming some complicated calculations on the CFT side to calculating what happens to classical fields in ADS space in this type 2B supergravity. Of course, there will be some corrections, and you can think about this as really another type of expansion. So typically people do, you know, because they cannot calculate things exactly, they do some expansions. And here the expansion is, if you want, in large NC. So there will be 1 over NC, so there will be 1 over NC corrections and 1 over lambda corrections. Because we are doing the expansion, these two parameters goes to infinity. And you can show that actually the contributions will be at the order of lambda to 3 halves and NC square. So that's the leading contributions, which go beyond this thing here. Okay, and so that's the prescription. So now, of course, we want to use this to calculate something. And the way we will be using it is that we can do simple calculation here. And then, you know, this better gives us some interesting answer on this side here. So that's how typically the ADS CFT is used. So now I put this source term J, right? So, well, you know how to do that on the field theory side. So you know that if you're calculating the partition function and you have some S0, which is your action, and then you want to perturb your action by inserting some operator, what you typically do is that you change your S0 to ddx ox jx. Well, this is the source for that operator. So now you perturb your theory, and so on the left hand side, this J is simply this source thing here, right? The simplest example which we already seen in classical physics is, well, you want to calculate the expectation value of, let's say, the current J. Well, this is the other way around. Anyway, so the example of this would be J mu A mu term. Right, so that would be one example where you could do this. Or another term would be T mu nu, delta G mu nu. Right, so there would be another example. So A mu, J mu would be an example. T mu nu, delta G mu nu would be another example, and so on. Right, so this is how you do things here. So you upgrade your action by doing this. And then you have to calculate this partition function, which we'll do in a minute. But you know what the source is here on the left-hand side is easy, right? So you know it from your quantum field theory course. Question is, what is the source here? What is this? So now we are talking about classical fields in ADS space. And the question is, you know, what can I say is the source for these classical fields in the ADS space? So that I can really calculate this thing here. And we will try to answer this. So building the dictionary, if we can identify that source J here on the right-hand side, then we can start using this for calculations. Building the dictionary. And for that is something which is called state operator correspondence. And so let me first, so on the CFT side, so we will have precisely, you know, the corresponding operator. So we have operators. And on these operators, because, well, we have CFT, so you have, in particular, you have Poincaré invariants, So these operators will be characterized by the spin, but also by the scaling dimension, because that's something what was the extension of the Poincaré group. So operators characterized by spin and scaling dimension. Scaling dimension. Okay, so we'll be interested in the scaling dimension. So, for example, you can have a scale operator which will have zero spin, but that will also have some scaling dimension delta. Okay, scaling dimension delta. Or you can have a vector operator which will have the index mu as a vector, but it will also have some kind of dimension here. Okay, and so just remind that. What we had is that under transformation x to x prime, well, let's just do the scaling. Under transformation x to lambda x, you know, the corresponding field, or let's just call it operator so that it's very good. Well, OK. O goes to lambda to minus delta O, where, you know, this will be true at the classical. Well, anyway, so that's how the scaling dimension of the operator is sort of defined. And so then we will call this operator to have the dimension delta, okay? And so if I start putting some indices, so this is a scale operator if no indices are there, but if I can put an index mu here, index mu, that would be a vector operator with that delta and stuff like that, right? And so specifically what I want you to recall is that if you have a primary, I don't explain what primary is, but you probably know, scalar operator, then the two-point function Ox, Oy is given by x minus y to 2 delta, okay? So this is with the operator delta. Okay, so this is what we need to know from the CFT side. Yes?
We did talk about primary operators in QFS. I never really understood.
So think about it like a family of operators. And so let's say one of them is the fundamental operator. Let's say a scalar field phi. Okay? And then that you will call that primary. And then, but in that family, there is many, many more operators, which you get by acting with a derivative on these things. So you have d mu phi, will live in the same family. You're just getting that by acting with derivatives on that operator. And these will be like secondary operators in that family, right? So it's like, so there's always like one guy, and then you can get many more by differentiation.
Is it not possible that primary operator is a derivative of something else?
Then it wouldn't be primary, right? Right. But remember, right? So what this thing is telling you is like how things scale, right? But if you start taking the derivatives, right? What happens if you start taking the derivatives? You are doing d over dx mu, so you introduce that has some dimensions of length, right? So what it will do is that it will change, start changing this delta. If your operator O, which you start with, has delta, then if you take dO, right, then this delta will change by one, right? And so they will have different scaling dimensions in that family. But anyway, so it's not important. So there's something which is called primary, the simplest operator you can think about. It's a scalar operator, then this is true. Okay? So very good. So that's what's on the CFT side is. So now, how do we build this dictionary to that? So now on ADS side, so to find what this corresponds to on ADS side, typically people just, you know, say, well, I want something which looks to have the same symmetries. Correspond to on ADS side, we match symmetries. So this is very vague, but anyway, match symmetries. But it's that simple as you might think. Okay, so you have a scale operator here. Okay, so that doesn't have any spin or whatever, right? So then what could be the corresponding field on the ADS side, which corresponds to a scalar operator? Any guesses? What kind of field? Could it be a graviton? A scalar field, right? Exactly, right? So if it's a graviton, I have two Lorentz indices. This guy doesn't have any Lorentz indices. So I better match scalar operator to scalar field, okay? So example would be that actually, so if you have a scalar operator over here, so two scalar operator O delta, the corresponding bulk field must be scalar. Let's call it phi. So it's a scalar field. But now let's think about, so I'm telling you there's some kind of delta, right? So that delta is a number or whatever that characterizes your scalar operator, right? Okay. So you know, having two scalar operators with two different deltas, I cannot have the same scalar field because they would be a disaster. So what do you think, where is the delta encoded? So how can I characterize my scalar field in the bulk? Can I distinguish two scalar fields by something? Sorry?
Exactly.
It's precisely by mass. Okay, so by scalar with the specific mass. Thank you. Specific mass, and that specific mass is given by m square l square equals to delta times delta minus d. Don't worry, you will derive this relation on your own. So this equation here tells me, well, okay, so I have a scalar operator on the CFT side. The thing which corresponds to that has to be a scalar in the bulk, scalar field in the bulk, classical scalar field in the bulk of that given mass m, which is given, which you know, when I fix delta, I know what m is. Okay? And of course, this scalar field, you should be thinking about it like, really, I have to put that scalar field consistently on that background of ADS5, process 5. So what you are really doing is that you are sort of perturbing. So you know, your ADS5 process 5 comes as a solution of this supergravity, right? So in particular, our brains came from the fact that we said, well, all the fields of supergravity are zero except the phi form, F5, and except the graviton. Right, so now what you can do is that you can start perturbing these things. You say, well, okay, so what if my graviton has some perturbations? I'll suddenly consider g mu nu plus delta g mu nu in the bulk, and then let's say F5 plus delta F5, right? And then I start playing with these things, and it comes down that these perturbations satisfy some kind of equations, right? So this scalar field better satisfy some kind of equation. And what you can show is that if you close a Klein on this S5, you completely neglect what's happening on the S5, and you're just interested in what's happening on the ADS part, it will just be the standard Klein-Gorin equation. Okay? And so this satisfies phi, satisfies, you know, some kind of equation of motion. In our case, it will be just box on ADS5 on 5 equals to m square on phi. Okay, so the bulk fields will be on shell, and they will have to satisfy the corresponding equations of motion. Yes.
Okay. I feel like I've never fully understood the meaning of an operator on the boundary. What does it really mean for an operator to live on the boundary, or what does it physically correspond to?
Well, So I don't know. So typically what you are interested in is, like, let's say I consider a condensed matter system, right? And then I inject some you know, source of, let's say, the electrons and whatever. And now I'm interested in the response of the corresponding plasma and stuff like that, right? So that will be, this will be always described by some kind of operator. So for what you may be interested in is, like, what is the current induced in the plasma, in the condensed matter system. So in that case, your operator will be exactly the current, right? So you're interested in, you know, what is the expectation of the current in your field theory, right? So you're interested in the expectation value of the current, and so the operator is the current, right? And so this will somehow correspond to that you inject something there, so that's precisely the source for that current. So I don't know if that. It's still a very physical intuition. Or you may be interested in the expectation value of the T mu nu, of the energy momentum tensor, right? So you're interested in, like, what is the energy density, you're interested in what is the pressure, you're interested in what the shears are and stuff like that, right? So your operator is T mu nu, right? And then, you know, this will be a response to something which you have done, so there'll be some corresponding source, which will be like a gravitational perturbation of your background, right? So you think about it like that. Yes?
So if we solve the bulk integration motion and find the phi, we take the limit phi to be bounded, the phi.
Oh, very good. Yeah, exactly. That's a very good expectation. I will tell you exactly. Okay? Yeah. That's a very good expectation. Yes?
In this mass expression, we identify, like, different deltas with the two different deltas with the same mass.
Okay, I will tell you as well. So please wait 1 second, okay? So this was an example of a scalar field, but more generally, as I said, we may be interested in expectation value of the energy momentum tensor and stuff like that. So more generally, is a useful table for us, which we'll use. And so you have a table with several entries. So you have operator on the CFT side. Okay, there will be one entry. And then you have the corresponding field in ADS. And then, you know, there's this relation between the mass, so M versus delta. Okay, so we already know one entry. So if you want scalar O delta, and we know that the corresponding field is just a scalar field, and then this is the thing, M square L square is delta times delta minus D. Okay, so that's how the scalar behaves. So now let's say I want precisely, so when we'll be discussing you know, the viscosity of the fluid, we'll be calculating something related to T mu nu. So there's T mu nu, so you are interested in the operator on the CFT side is T mu nu, and the corresponding bulk field will be the graviton, the linearized perturbation of gravitational field, H mu nu. And in that case, you can show that this T mu nu has always delta equal to D if you are in D dimensions. Okay, very good. So, okay, let me finish this. And then what it means is that M square, L square is really zero. So graviton in the bulk has equal to mass equal to zero. That's what we would be very happy about. And then when we will be discussing holographic superconductors, you'll be interested in the expectation value of the current, J mu, and then the corresponding gauge field in the bulk is just a vector potential, A mu, it's a gauge field, and then M square, L square. This need not be Maxwell, so it can have some mass, and then this is given by delta minus 1, delta plus 1 minus D. Okay, so that's the table which is useful for us. But let me just warn you, what I just did, and you should have stopped me here, is that I introduced this general dimension T, right? So So all that what we are saying there is ADS5/CFT4, right? What we are doing now here is that we are doing ADS D+1/CFTD. Okay, so we already generalized this notion here, and we expect that, you know, that there may be something more general, and that you can very well motivate ADS4/CFT3 from string theory, but you know, it's expected that in general D there will be some correspondence between ADS D+1 and CFTD. Okay, so that's why I'm putting the general D here, but of course for that case over there, D is just equal to 4. Yes.
Sorry for all the questions. This might be a bit too philosophical, but okay. Say you have team union. So would it be like the observation of the stress energy tensor gives rise to like the graviton field, or is it the existence of the stress energy tensor that gives rise to the graviton? Because it is the opposite.
Okay. So this is what you are interested in on the CFT side. You are interested in expectation value of T mu nu, or expectation what the current is, or expectation of what, you know, what is the expectation value, or two-point function of the scalar field and stuff like that, three-point function of these things, whatever, right? So this is what you are interested in on the CFT side. This is way how you do this, right? You're using that nice correspondence, and the statement is, if I want to find expectation value of O, I have to study a scalar field in ADS, or, you know, tensor field in ADS, or gauge field in ADS of that given mass. Okay, that's the statement. Okay, so let us be a little bit more concrete. So let's be a bit more concrete. And that will also answer the questions which are already here. Like, okay, very good. So I study, you know, this scalar field that, you know, that graviton field or whatever in the bulk. But how does that really give me, you know, that source J, and how do I really calculate the right hand side, right? So for this thing, let's consider this, you know, scalar in ADSD plus one. Okay, in Poincaré coordinates. So let's consider a scalar field like that. And then you know that the action S is equal to, well, there'll be some constant, which is not important for us at this point, but let's put it there. So we can just write S is proportional to, and I just now write the standard action for a massive scalar field in ADS space. But because I'm using these Poincaré coordinates, so there will be the coordinates dx mu, there's d of them, but there will also be a coordinate dz. Okay, so there will be dz, and then there will be dd x, right, using the Poincaré coordinates, and there will be the standard action for this. Okay, and I'll do it in the Euclidean setting, so I will big rotate the time so that it looks the same as all the other coordinates. So that will be just square root of g, and then gab da phi db phi plus m square phi square. That's your action of massive scalar. But what you will demand is that, you know, the mass here of that scalar is related, if you are interested in, you know, in some operator of dimension delta, it's related to delta by that prescription over here. Okay. So now, okay, let's leave it like that. So this is the effective thing which you have to study. That's the action for your perturbation in the bulk. And let's look at what it gives us. So what do we get from here? So first of all, from here we get the standard equations of motion which I already write down. So the first step will be like, equations of motion, which you of course get by varying phi of this action here, and so they are this thing here, box ADS 5 minus m squared phi equal to 0, where the box is given by your favorite divergence formula. So the box on phi is just 1 over square root of g, square root of g, gab, db phi, a. Okay, you differentiate with respect to a. So this is how your box looks like. And if you write it down explicitly, so what you are now doing is that you're writing in that space-time over there, but what I'll be doing a big rotated time. So eta mu nu really is delta mu nu. This is just, you know, Riemannian metric here. So anyway, what you find is that this box, more explicitly, well, okay, do it as an exercise, okay? It's an exercise one line. So this box is 1 over L square, z square, d square with respect to z, minus d minus 1, z dz, plus z square delta mu nu, d mu d nu. So this will be like a box operator with respect to this delta metric here. Okay. And then what you will do is that you can consider, well, what we'll be doing at the end of the lecture maybe is that we'll be doing the full Fourier transformation. But let's, for the moment, let's just do that phi is e to I k x, it's phi k of z e to I k mu x mu. Okay, so you are considering the plane waves in these x directions. But then you single out z. Of course, more generally, this will be an integral over dk. It will be the Fourier transformation here, right? But let's just do this at this point. And then if you plug this ansatz into your box equation, what you will find that your box equation or your equation of motion looks like this. Z square d square z of phi k minus d minus 1 z dz of phi k minus m square l square plus k square z square on phi k is equal to 0. Okay, so that's your Klein-Gordon equation in the ADS space. Okay. So we will have to, so remember this, you know, this equation star, and we will have to solve this equation exactly at some point, but let's not do it yet. Instead, let's look at how this equation behaves close to the boundary. Okay, so how does it look like close to the boundary? So now, close to boundary, which is at z equal to 0. Well, if z is equal to 0, then this term is definitely smaller than that term, unless m is equal to 0, right? But so I can neglect this term here. So you're neglecting k squared z squared term here. OK, and then you get some relatively nice equation. There was z squared, two derivatives, z, one derivative, and then just constant times phi k. OK, and so you can solve this equation by doing an ansatz that phi k is z to some power. OK, and then you plug that ansatz into this equation, and you find what that power has to be. OK, so in this case, close to boundary, you do phi k to some power. And what you find is that we have, you know, you plug that and you get some equation for that power, right? You can do it yourself. And this equation will be actually quadratic and it will have two solutions. So close to the boundary, you will have two independent solutions, which you know because it's a second order differential equation. So you have to have two independent solutions, right? So close to the boundary, we have two independent solutions. solutions, and so phi k is either that to delta plus, okay? So that's the right power, and we'll call this solution, so it will behave like that to delta plus, and this and we'll call this normalizable solution for reason I will never explain. And then you will have another solution, z to delta minus, which is non-normalizable. Solution, where this delta plus and delta minus, surprise, surprise, will be precisely given by this formula over here. So as you noted, this formula is quadratic in delta, and so it has two solutions, delta plus and delta minus, and if you solve that equation, you'll find that delta plus minus is t over 2 plus minus square root of d square over 4 plus m square l square, okay? So far, so easy, right? So now, so what it means is that my solution goes to the boundary. So that is my solution goes to the boundary. It looks like, you know, something phi zero of x, and then z to delta minus plus something which is called phi plus of x. Z to delta plus other things. So this is the solution, how it looks like close to the boundary.
Sorry, can you give us a hint with the exercise?
Sorry?
Can you give us a hint? I don't really see why that.
What do you mean, hint? So.
Exercise, you can prove it in one line, but I don't see why it.
Oh, you will do it in your homework, don't worry.
Okay.
So that's why your homework is designed, so that you actually go through this calculation.
Okay.
You will do it in slightly different coordinates, but it's the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So don't worry. You will see it explicitly. Okay. So now, very deep mathematical statement, okay? So if you fix delta plus here, and then look at what delta minus is. Right, so you see that they differ by the square root, but if I do delta plus minus delta, well, if I sum them or whatever, you find that the difference between them is precisely t. It's a deep mathematical statement, okay? Deep mass here is that we observe that delta minus is d minus delta plus, okay? Very, very deep mass. And you can check that, right? Okay, very, very deep. Mass.
Wait, so are phi not supposed to be a naught or a phi minus?
Say it again. It's denoted for some reason by phi zero. Yeah. yeah. Sorry.
It's supposed to be like.
So okay, very good. So one more second, okay? So very good. So now let's see what we are doing, right? We are trying to somehow identify the scalar field with the operator which has dimension delta, right? What it means is that the operator transforms under scalings as lambda to minus delta, okay? So now, how would an expectation value of this operator transform under the scaling? It would also transform as lambda to minus delta, okay? So very good. So now if I say that I identify delta plus with delta, okay? So if I say that, you know, it's this delta plus which will be the scaling of the operator, then this goes like length to power delta. So this guy here, because the whole thing better be dimensionless, goes like length to minus delta. Okay, so it has the scaling of z to minus delta, which is precisely how the operator should transform. Okay, so what this thing here can be identified is by just, you know, this dimensional argument, is that this thing here is the expectation value or at least from the dimensionality or whatever, right? Expectation value of O delta. So if I say delta plus is delta, okay, then this the meaning, physical meaning of this phi plus, well, at least it has the right dimensions or the right scaling as the expectation value of your operator O delta. Okay. But then what is this phi zero here? Well, it has the dimensions of length to delta minus. But delta minus here has t minus delta. Okay, so now if I'm looking at this source equation here, if I'm looking at this thing here, right? Operator O has some dimensions. This has dimensions d. The source then has d minus the dimensions of operator O, right? Because the whole thing has to be dimensionless. This has dimensions d. This has dimensions 1 over delta. This has to have d minus delta. OK, that's precisely the dimensions of phi 0 here. So this thing here will be the source for your thing. And so then, you know, it answers your question, like, how do I know what the source is? And the statement is, if you want to identify the source over here, the J here, it is this phi 0. But what is this phi 0? It's the leading order expansion of the of your scale of field, of your bulk field, on the boundary. OK, so source is the leading order expansion of phi on the boundary. Okay, so you really now know what you need to do. So basically what you have to do is that you have to solve your equations of motion, okay, and then the solution will depend on this phi zero, right? It's a boundary condition if you want. So now you express your solution in terms of the phi zero. You plug it back to the action. If you remember your classical physics course, what you are really doing is that you are calculating the Hamilton's function, right? You first solve the equations of motion. You find the solution in terms of your boundary value problem. And then you plug it back to the action. You evaluate your action as function of q0 and q final and stuff like that, right? And so then your action depends on this q0. And that's what you call Hamilton's function. And then by differentiating this Hamilton's function, you could get all the all the solution of the whole problem, right? That's what we have done in the classical physics course. So now we are doing exactly the same thing here, but for a field, right? So we will be solving the equations of motion for the field. You'll be expressing the solution in terms of the boundary value problem, in terms of phi 0. We plug it back to the action. We have our Hamilton's function. Okay, but that's precisely what enters here. It's precisely this guy over here. Okay, and so that's what gives us the partition function for the CFT. Okay, so we have a procedure. I know that you were just about to ask a question. Were you? Okay. So by the way, remember, so this phi zero, right? So you can find this phi zero as a limit z goes to zero of phi, the full thing, z and x, and then z to delta minus d. Okay, so this is how you find this phi zero, just inverting that thing here. Okay, so we have a recipe. Well, not really, but okay, recipe. And so what you want to do is that in order to calculate the right hand side, right? So we first determine, so you want to calculate something about some you know operator on the CFT side. So you first determine bulk phi, which is dual to your operator. Okay, so that's what the table is good for. Then you solve the equations of motion for phi. And these equations of motion, you know, generally come from the supergravity, but they are simply something like this, right, for phi. Subject to boundary conditions. Condition which is that phi z and x goes like z to d minus delta times phi 0 as z goes to 0. Okay, so that's your boundary thing. So this is really the leading order thing. And then, you know, plug this back to the action. Plug back to the action for this field phi, and so you obtain something like Hamilton's function. So this is what basically your Hamilton's function. Okay. And what that gives you is it gives you the S supergravity, which will now depend on this source, which I call phi zero, is the boundary value of the field, S sugra, which is precisely this, you know, S sugra of phi, where you do limit z goes to 0 phi zx z to delta minus d goes to phi 0. Okay, so that's just saying that the phi 0 is really the boundary condition for that scalar field phi. Okay, so that's how you calculate the right-hand side of this guy here. So the source J is your phi 0, is the boundary value of the field. It's the classical field in the ADS. Its boundary value is the source. And that's what gives you the partition function for the CFT side, right? So now remind, so this is the procedure. So remind that if you want to calculate the partition function on the left-hand side, so z of phi 0 on the CFT. On CFT side, the z of phi 0 is just, you know, some pass integral of e to minus a 0, and then it's plus d dx ox phi 0 of x. So this is the source, this is the operator. Okay, and so this is the expectation value of this thing here, d dx ox phi 0 of x. But once you calculate the partition function, this gives you the free energy, right? So now, this is the free energy thing, right? So I'm doing a trace of minus e to beta h, right? And so once I calculate that, that gives me exponential of the free energy. Once I have the free energy w, I can calculate anything I want. In particular, you can calculate the correlation functions. So then, if you want an expectation value OX1, OXN, then this is given by, you just differentiate this W with respect to delta phi 0 X1, delta phi 0 X2, delta phi 0 XN. Okay? So this is what you know from the CFT side, how you do the calculation of correlation functions here. But now look at what the ADS is really doing is that it's telling you, well, I can approximate this as Z to F0 by that thing over there, by exponential e to minus s of supergravity. But we know what that s supergravity is. It's just this thing here, right? So what really the ADS CFT is doing here, so this is equal to e to minus s supergravity of phi 0. That's what the ADS CFT is doing for you, right? And so you know how to calculate correlation functions, for example, on the CFT side by just doing the supergravity calculation. You find the supergravity action by this procedure, right? Once you have that, you know that the supergravity action is given, it gives you this free energy W of phi 0. So really what the key result of the ADS CFT here is that it's no space, no time. It's horrible. W phi 0 as the most important thing is as sugra phi 0. Okay? So that's what the ADS CFT correspondence gives you. So you know how to calculate this, but through the ADS CFT, that gives you precisely the free energy over there. Once you have the free energy, you can calculate everything on the CFT side. Isn't this amazing? Okay.
Why is scaling dimension of phi 0?
Sorry, why does... This is a good question. So, is that obvious somehow from... Well, there's some dimensions in the C here as well. So I think what is arranged over here is that the C is really a dimension full constant, so that the phi here is really dimensionless. Okay, so you can arrange that. So the C is something like G Newton in 10 dimensions. 1 over G Newton in 10 dimensions, this has dimensions D minus 2. Then would it work? This has D plus 1. Still not convenient. Anyway, I think, it's a good point. We should figure it out, right? So this has D plus 1. And then there's two derivatives here. So it's like D minus 1. And that's right, yeah. So if this C is like 1 G, over G Newton, right, so that will precisely cancel all the dimensions, and the phi will be dimensionless. Thanks for that question.
What was the S type 2V supergravity again? What was this? Yeah, the action.
Oh, it's that thing over here which we just calculated, right?
Yeah, I know we calculated it, but I still don't really know what it is.
Do you know what a Hamilton function is for classical physics, right? You solve the equations of motion, you find them as a function of the boundary value problem. So you have second order equations of motion, you integrate them, you find them as a function of two constants, you express these two constants in terms of the boundary value data, right? And so then you have S as a function of Q0, right? So if you go from Q0 to Q final, right, so then I can write down as my action as a function of Q0 and Q final. Right, so in this case, you just have one boundary sort of. So anyway, Q0, right? And then you have some miraculous things like if you differentiate with respect to Q0, you get something like P, is that true? Something like that. So anyway, once you know this Hamilton function, you can calculate almost anything you want. So in classical physics, it will be like ds over dq zero. I think it gives you something like momentum and stuff like that. So you can start calculating from here all the quantities, right? So here you are doing exactly the same thing, except now you don't have a particle trajectory, but you have the scale of field, which is valid everywhere in the bulk.
And why is it super? Why is it a supergravity?
Okay. So because the whole thing, at least in this setting here, comes from matching whatever happens in the type 2b superstring, and the Young-Mills theory, the classical limit of type 2b superstring is supergravity. So in principle, you have to be considering the fields which live, which are in the supergravity context or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And yeah.
Okay.
You cannot always make delta plus to any delta.
Very good. So very good. Yes. Yes and no. So what I said here is that delta plus is equal to delta, right? Why didn't I choose delta plus delta minus equal to delta? So that would be another choice. And the statement is, can I make this choice? No, if the mass of the field is positive. Okay, but the mass of the field need not be positive in ADS space. Okay, so that may be the last thing in 2 minutes we can do that. So you may be thinking, very good, so it's somewhere here, but anyway. So we are setting, in ADS space, we have been considering the scale of field with mass m, which was sort of like, we assume it's positive, right? But it need not be. And, so as a remark, we have a remark before we go home. So remark, in ADS, m square need not be positive. Okay, and so there's something which is called BF bound, which tells you that, well, I can have slightly negative m square, but it cannot be arbitrary large negative. And so, what's happening here, right? So if you have a potential, so if you have positive m square, then you have something which is stable, right? So let's say I have a potential like this. So it's plus m square, whatever, phi square. And then I have a bead here, and so the bead can go up like this, but it's basically stable around this minimum, right? So this would be for positive thing, right? But if I have negative thing, I would have potential something like this, right? And then if I have a bead, well, it just goes away and it's unstable situation. So this would be unstable. So this is the reason why in flat space, you cannot have negative m square, because if you had negative m square, you would be in this situation, and your field would be unstable. Okay, so in flat space, m square, phi square better be positive. Okay, but let's look at something here. So you take that action for the scalar field in ADS, as we had it before. So it's still somewhere written here. And then what you assume here for simplicity is that phi is just function of z. I just forget, I set k equal to 0, right? The k is not important here. So we had before phi z e to I k x. So let's just do phi z. And let's see what the action looks like. And it looks like this. And then this comes from the determinant. And this comes from the inverse metric, dz phi, dz phi. Again, I'm using the Poincaré coordinates from m square, l square, phi square. So that's what your action is. And then, this looks like a horrible mess. There's this z square and there's this z to something here. But now you can do a change of coordinates. You choose a new phi. So this is the old phi, is z to d over 2, and then the new phi. New phi, okay? So you just do a change of coordinates here, like that. And if you can do it again, and then I think what you find that this thing here is like dz ddx of, oh, now I'm worried. Maybe there's some transformation of z as well. Anyway, let me write it like this, and you can try to do it, or we can do it in the tutorial maybe. So anyway, so there's this dz of phi, dz of phi, and then, so there's no funny business anymore. So there's no z to any power, and there's no z to any power over here. But the price to pay is that now your m square gets shifted. And you find that this is equal to m square l square plus d square over 4 phi square. Okay? So this is how your action looks like now if you do this change of the field. There must be some transformation of z, right? Oh, okay, anyway, we can do it. So is a quick question?
Yeah. Like, what happened to the xn, like the x derivatives in the action?
Oh, sorry. So I'm just doing the simplest case where phi is only function of z. Let's just forget about the x dependence. Just, you know, it's good enough for this argument. Just do the simplest case which gives you the right result, okay? So just phi is a function of z. We do this change of variables, and then what do you find here? But now look at this. This looks like flat space, right? This looks like flat space. It's just the mass is different. So there's some effective mass here. Effective square, right? But because now you are in flat space, well, this effective mass better be equal or bigger than 0, right? Because otherwise we would be unstable. So we are getting a very nice result here that m effective square better be equal to 0, bigger or equal than 0, which means that m square l square better be equal or bigger than minus d square over 4. So this is called, yeah, I never know how to say Brighton-Lohner. Friedman. But much more simply, BF. Bound. Okay? BF bound. And so what it tells you is that yes, you can still have stable fields in ADS space. Their mass can be, mass square can be negative, but it cannot be too negative. It must be bigger than something which depends on your dimension, right? Such fields will still be stable, although they have negative mass, and they will be unstable in asymptotically flat space. Very important for holographic superconductors, as we shall see next week. Very important for other things as well, right? But to somebody else's question, like we were identifying delta equal to delta plus, okay? So the question is, can I identify delta equal to delta minus? And the statement is, yes, if you are close to this negative bound. If you are somewhere, you know, close to minus d squared over 4 for your mass, then actually, yes, the things about the phi 0 and phi plus, the meaning of them can be interchanged. If you have m square l square negative, sufficiently negative, but still bigger than this. Okay, so there's some range of masses and some range of deltas where, you know, the identification between the source and the expectation value can interchange. Okay, which is something I never understood, but anyway. So that's okay, let me stop here. Sorry for going over time. Questions?
I don't see how this is stable in ADS. Like, it's a stable in flat space with this thing.
So this will be stable in flat space, but you know this is just a change of variables, right? So you know this thing here looks like flat space, so we know that this guy has to be positive, and then we are fine, right? But what it means is that in ADS it can be a little bit negative. More questions? So weird things happening in ADS, right? Okay, you continue on Wednesday.